Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. You're welcome to call in to ask questions and make comments during the show. There are a number of services available through our organization Toward the Light, providing near-death studies and support, Reiki and remote healing, psychic, spiritual, grief, and motivational counseling, NDE books and DVDs, and other products and services for body, mind, and spirit. I'd like to encourage you to help support this program and Toward the Light by sponsoring a show or sending a donation. For more information, please see the website towardthelight.org. Well, sounding a bit like Mercury's retrograde right now. My tongue is all twisted. I apologize for that. This week, we've got a special guest who is the author of Induced After-Death Communications, a New Therapy for Healing Grief and Trauma. And this is very fascinating because I saw Dr. Alan Botkin at the IANS conference in Chicago in 2004 and was seriously taking notes. It's very, very fascinating, and I'm so pleased to have Dr. Alan Botkin. Welcome, Doctor. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing just fine, and thank you so much, Juliet, for having me on your show.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's really wonderful to have you, and I'm so pleased about this because this work that you're doing is very significant and something that, of course, I've kind of been involved with just the fact that I'm a medium, so I can naturally do this. But why don't you tell us first what got you into this this work, what got you interested in ADCs and IADCs?
Well, I have to be honest with you and tell you that I completely stumbled upon this. And to give you the quick nutshell version, I was working as a clinical psychologist in a local VA hospital in the Chicago area, and I was treating combat veterans with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. And in the early 90s, a new and remarkable treatment came out, and which is called EMDR, or Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. And we began to use that on our post-traumatic stress disorder unit about 15 years ago in the early 90s, and we found that we could help people heal at a much more rapid and efficient way than with any available therapies that we had been using.
Now, was this this wasn't centered in the grief yet, right? This is just to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, correct?
Well, yeah, my specialty was post-traumatic stress disorder, but I became a grief specialist sort of by default because so many of the traumas that I was working with involved the death of somebody close to my patient. So for many years, I had been doing grief work secondarily to working with post-traumatic stress disorder. But anyway, this new approach came out called EMDR, or Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing, and in the early 90s, and we began to use it with our patients, and the effect was absolutely remarkable. And the best way to explain what it could do or what it does is that the difference between a normal memory and a traumatic memory is when one remembers a traumatic memory, they not only remember it, they also relive the moment.
Yes.
So many of our veterans who were traumatized 30 years prior to coming into the hospital, when they would bring up a traumatic memory, they felt like they were reliving it, like it happened yesterday, and it's like it's happening all over again. The beauty of this EMDR approach is that it took the reliving component completely out of the memory. And the EMDR involves having the patient move his or her eyes in a particular rhythmic fashion from left to right, while at the same time attending to something that's troubling or bothersome or traumatic. And what we find in a consistent way is whatever the patient is attending to at the time becomes rapidly processed and provides a good amount of healing for our patients. Now, what people generally ask me, what could it be about moving the eyes back and forth that can take the reliving component out of a traumatic memory? And our best guess at this point, which most EMDR therapists agree with, is that when we dream at night, our brains are actually processing information more rapidly and efficiently than when we are awake. And it has been believed for some time that this increased processing during dreaming causes our eyes to dart back and forth, which is why they call dream sleep REM sleep or rapid eye movement.
Yes.
So the discovery of EMDR appears to be you can take a fully awake person and have her move her eyes in a similar fashion, and you actually put the brain into that high processing mode while people are wide awake. So the EMDR procedure seems to rely on a mechanism that already exists in all of us, but is not active unless it's the person is asleep and dreaming. So we can draw upon that healing aspect of the brain while people are wide awake and help them process traumas. When I was at the VA, we were getting results using the standard EMDR approach that were almost unbelievable. We found that we could help our patients process traumatic memories in a single session and be done with it.
Can you describe a session? What exactly takes place? Can you describe a session? What typically takes place?
Generally, the way eye movement works, and I'll give you the nutshell version without going into the detailed protocol, but you have the patient pay attention to a troubling aspect of a traumatic memory or a loss, and then while they are attending to that private event, you get them to move their eyes left and right in a particular rhythmic fashion, and that you generally get the patient to do that by have them tracking something that you're moving in front of their eyes.
Okay.
And as long as they are attending to that troublesome aspect of the memory and moving their eyes at the same time, that aspect of the memory becomes processed and heals very rapidly.
Wow.
So that had been happening for some time when I began to experiment with a number of variations on this EMDR procedure, and I changed it significantly. As a matter of fact, I changed it to the point that I really wasn't doing the standard EMDR protocol anymore. I was doing it in a very different kind of way that I thought would help my patients heal even more rapidly and efficiently. But what I did after making a number of changes to the procedure, a number of my patients began to report after-death communications at the end of the session. And to be honest with you, at first I didn't even know what that was. I thought my patients were hallucinating. I had not yet read the Guggenheim's Hello from Heaven and their wonderful survey and all the other books on after-death communication.
That's a wonderful book. That's a wonderful book.
I think that is the standard in the field, and that's why I call my procedure induced after-death communication and follow the terminology that the Guggenheims presented. But I was aware of NDEs. I had read Raymond Moody's book all the way back in the 70s and followed some of that research. And I was very fascinated by NDE experiences. As a matter of fact, many of my combat veterans who I was working with, many of them reported near-death experiences. So I was very intrigued by those kind of experiences. So when my patients began reporting after-death communications, after I had, you know, altered this EMDR procedure significantly, they sounded to me like near-death experiences. Many of my patients went through tunnels before meeting and communicating with the deceased. They experienced the deceased in beautiful, radiant landscapes, and so on and so forth. But it immediately struck me that they were very NDE-like. But
yes.
As I was saying, soon after that, I realized there was such a thing as an after-death communication. And surprisingly, I found that they were very common. So when I began asking my patients, did you ever have an NDE experience? And once they're asked, they tend to volunteer. But once I understood what after-death communications were, my patients also began to volunteer that they had that experience as well. So I realized that these changes I had made to EMDR led me into this realm of after-death communication that I think has strong similarities to near-death experiences. That's the short version.
That's interesting. Yes, that's very interesting too, because I am a medium as well as a multiple in the ear, and I've told people that it's very natural to be a medium, and in fact, I'm convinced that as children we are mediums, but we're conditioned out of it. And so now, you know, with people like you coming forward and you know, doing this work, and I was so fascinated when I was listening to you speak at the conference, because I thought, aha, you know, here's somebody who can scientifically validate ADCs, and, you know, which is really another term for being a medium, because
it
is very natural to have this kind of communication, and we become more sensitive, more receptive, what have you, and...
Right.
So
I think receptive is the key word that you just used.
Yes.
When I use this variation of EMDR, and it's really not EMDR anymore, it's really IADC, which is very different. But it's all about getting the patient into a receptive or very open frame of mind. I do not induce the experience itself. I induce a frame of mind that then allows the experience to naturally happen. But the other main point is to get a person to be able to get receptive, I first use the EMDR or the eye movement procedure to help people process the sadness. And it's my experience that this deep, profound sadness that people experience actually gets in the way of allowing people to naturally have the experience. Even people who have suffered severe losses do not spontaneously experience an after-death communication when they are in experiencing deep, profound grief, or they have a strong desire to have the experience. People who have these experiences spontaneously report them sort of coming out of the blue. You know, they're not even thinking of the deceased at the time. They're just kind of open to the possibility of the experience.
When people are, and I've certainly had my share of grief, that's for sure, when people are in such a deep state of grief, it's like they are completely contracted or constricted, so they can't be receptive, and it's like they've got a wall around them. So I think that you're really right on here, that when they're open, just spontaneous, it's going to be more likely to happen, because then they're more open. Go ahead.
It sounds like our experiences or observations are the same. Yes, and they only happen when people are. As a matter of fact, most spontaneous ADCs that that patients report to me occur when people are asleep, but they report them to be very different from dreams. Sometimes people call them dreams, but they have a clarity that dreams do not have, and they tend to be remembered for a lifetime.
And they're very lucid, probably.
Yes, yes. Now, whether the sadness just clouds consciousness in general, or if it is a sort of a darker, slower level of energy,
yes,
that prevents the communication, you know, it might be either one of those or both. But there's something about the deep sadness that does not allow it. So what I do is I use this powerful eye movement procedure to first process the grief. So people who come to see me really have to be ready to really go after their sadness. I mean, it's not an easy out.
Exactly.
They really have... Sure.
How do you... You know, encourage them to trust in the first place to be able to get into this procedure, because trust is an issue too, is it not?
I'm in a rather unique position because I'm very sensitive and aware of issues of trust, but I'm becoming a little sort of well-known because of radio shows I've done and the book, my book that's come out and so on. So people who come to see me are really, first of all, they're really wanting to work through their pain that they're living with on a daily basis. And they are willing to trust me just on reputation. But... how I interact with, you know, the patients that come to see me is critical as well, and I have to tell you that I am I'm sincerely interested in helping people who suffer, and that's my primary goal, and I do my best to communicate that to people who come to see me.
Well, I figure that this is something that you're very, very gifted at, and at the same time, it's just a good question to ask, because I know that, you know, whether somebody's approaching you for this help, for this therapy, or somebody else, just like if somebody's going to get into hypnosis, there's always the issue of trust and feeling at ease and being able to let go and open up and just to surrender to the process kind of thing. So that's why I wanted to ask about it. But this...
Feels
like a really, really positive thing. And so, so then you do the eye movement work, and then after that, then the ADCs start to occur. Is that correct?
Well, yes. And you know, regarding the issue of trust, patients generally wrap pretty quickly. Begin to understand that this eye movement really does work, which then bolsters whatever trust they have in me. Excuse me, because once we start the procedure, they find that their sadness begins to rapidly diminish. But anyway, once we get through the first part of therapy where we're processing this deep sadness, then I set it up, and I set up the after-death communication in a particular kind of way, which is somewhat subtle and involves psychotherapeutic technique, but it has to do with then using the eye movements to get a person into a receptive state where this can then naturally happen.
Typically last?
Well, I see people for two sessions, two 90-minute sessions generally. Sometimes the second session only goes 30 minutes because we don't need to go any longer and we're done. but oftentimes our second session lasts another 90 minutes. And I see people on two consecutive days. As a matter of fact, the way I'm set up at this point is most of my clients who come to see me are from out of state. And I have a nice setup with a hotel right next to my office, which is close to an airport and so on. And I see people on a Saturday morning and a Sunday morning. But that's really all the time we need. I move very fast. I completely explain the procedure to my patients, first of all, on the phone before they even make the trip. And then once they get here, I give them a full explanation. But then once we start, we put our foot on the gas and we go. And I'm really amazed by how many people are really willing to have the courage to face their pain and work their way through it. This procedure works quickly, but it's not an easy out. And for people who have lost, have very significant losses, like a spouse after many years of marriage, or, you know, I work with many parents who lose children. If that death is fairly recent, like within the last few months, sometimes it's very difficult for people to allow themselves to access that deep pain because their sadness is more fleeting. And in the early stages of grief, people are generally in a state of denial or disbelief or shock or numbing, where the full impact of the loss hasn't hit them yet. And my procedure is really works best sometime after that initial stage of grief, where their sadness is more crystallized and identifiable, and so then we can process it with the eye movement procedure.
Well, having been through that myself, I can certainly understand. And indeed, there are various stages of the grieving process, but also a big part of this work that we're all doing too. I think that as we can help people to understand that life is indeed eternal, and that you know, we've only lost the person's form, as it were, and not actually that being. You know.
Right.
Ideally, hopefully, the grief will be lessened, and also when people know that they can easily communicate with their departed loved ones, friends, what have you, that will be a tremendous, tremendous relief for them.
Yes, yes.
Now, have you found that people will, after having had a session with you, just spontaneously be able to have more ADCs? Or do you know?
Yes. My follow-up data isn't really good and not complete, but I have had reports of people saying that they then later spontaneously had an after-death communication, and that was probably a result of the fact that we were able to process their sadness when we were in session, and that opened them up to the possibility of this experience. In many cases, I also teach my clients how to use this at home. But I do that only after they have they're sort of over the hump in terms of their profound grief and sadness, so that they're able to carry on their own.
Do you give them information that is written, or is it all via counseling and what have you that helps them to do, you know, to have more ADCs and that sort of thing?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
I was asking you if you give them any written material or if it's all done via counseling.
Oh, yeah. No, it's just verbal. It's all done by counseling and the instructions I then give them.
Okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I had a woman who came in recently who routinely has spontaneous after-death communications on her own. And although I have talked to a number of people who routinely have those kind of experiences, most of them do not welcome the experiences. It's like, why am I getting this? And sometimes it doesn't involve, does not involve immediate family members. It can involve neighbors and so on. And some people, you know, it's like, you know, why are they coming to me? Why are they talking to me? And but I did have a woman recently who came to see me who routinely has these kind of experiences, and she wanted to have better control over them. And so I taught her how to self-induce the ADC experience, and she got really good at it, where it wasn't like a fleeting kind of thing where she would have the experience of somebody coming and talking to her and then leaving, and then she had no control over you know, furthering the conversation and so on. But she was then able to do that after she learned to self-induce. But I want to make the point now, while I have a chance, that as a psychologist, my main concern, my priority is to help people heal and not to push my own belief systems on people or get people to believe what I believe or other people believe. So I really remain strategically very neutral on the issue of whether these after-death communications are spiritually real or not. I think it's important for me to be in a position where I let my patients make up their own mind. And as a matter of fact, of extremely high percentage of people who have the experience believe the experience is real. And that even includes people who, prior to the sessions, our sessions were atheist and agnostic and so on. So there is, just like the NDE, there is something very convincing about these kinds of experiences.
Well, I think with all such a consistency with all of our testimonies about our experiences, you know, I've got my NDE, the big transcendent NDE that I had in the mid-70s, it's on my website and it's on a number of other websites as well. And, you know, when people read these and hear about them and seeing this constant thread that goes through all of them, that weaves through all of them,
right.
You know, and people can't help but to conclude, okay, there's something to this. It can't be, you can't make up something like that.
Yeah. They can't be sloughed off as hallucinations or byproducts of a dying brain. My patients who are very much healthy and alive experience nearly all the same elements of the NDE. So these experiences are certainly not simply byproducts of a dying brain.
Well, exactly. And one of my points about all of this, too, is the fact that we are multidimensional and we do exist on other dimensions simultaneously. And so having ADCs and you know, communicating this way, we're just tapping into these other dimensions that we also reside on simultaneously. And indeed, the veil is thinner. And one thing that I've shared when I've given instructions or tutoring, as it were, on mediumship is it's something that you relax into. You put yourself in a relaxed and receptive state. And it's just as natural as breathing when they start to happen.
Right. I like the word let. I often tell my patients to just let the experience happen.
Yeah.
Go wherever it takes you. Just
perfect.
Let the experience happen. You can't control it or make it happen. Just let it happen.
That's such a wonderful point. Thank you, Alan.
Many of my patients I work with, if they are meditators, they are much easier to work with because they understand experientially that concept that you let the experience happen. It's a natural experience. You can't force it or make it happen. You just let it happen.
Yes. That's a really valid point for people to hear. Now, when did you make this discovery and get into the process of ADCs, or IADCs, rather?
Well, it was, I stumbled into this, as I was explaining earlier, probably in the mid-90s, around 1995, and I was working in for the federal government in a VA hospital, and I was working with combat veterans, and I and a number of colleagues were using the IADC procedure, and I developed it while I was there, but we were pretty much doing this in secrecy, knowing that our administrators probably would not be very supportive of the concept. But so I had to leave the VA to bring this to the general public. The idea of keeping this secret after a few years didn't make sense to me. So I've been out on my own and bringing these ideas to the general public for the last 4 years or so.
Well, that's tremendous. Now, are you focusing in your practice mainly on IADCs, or are you still do you also work with the post-traumatic?
Actually, I work exclusively doing IADC at this point.
Aha. Uh-huh. And that actually, wouldn't you say that also helps people who are suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes. I don't see, I see grief and post-traumatic stress disorder I see them as overlapping significantly.
Yes.
And particularly when it comes to the death of somebody you're close to or who is important to you. Now, when it comes to post-traumatic stress disorder, there are also intrusive aspects of the loss. For example, people may have horrible images of seeing their loved one die that won't go away and so on.
Yeah.
And those intrusive images, for example, also need to be processed with the eye movement. But, you know, even when it comes to normal grief, where there's not that real traumatic component, there still are intrusive aspects of even normal grief. Like many people, often tell me, you know, the image of their loved one in a casket continues to be bothersome and intrudes, and they can't get that difficult image to go away and so on. So in some ways, even normal grief is similar to the more traumatic variety, traumatic grief. They overlap considerably, and I really treat both those the same, at least when PTSD involves the death of somebody.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and something that has bothered me for years and years is the fact that when people cross over, when they transition, a lot of people will put them in a casket and have viewings or wakes or whatever they call it, and it just seems strange to me because I feel like that's not the person, that's not what somebody
right.
should be focusing on. Interestingly
right.
enough, a few years ago when I was at a memorial and somebody had been cremated, and the person who was officiating over the
mm-hmm.
the service was holding up the urn, and here I am, a medium, right? And so meanwhile I was seeing the individual who just crossed over several feet away, and he was a musician, and
mm-hmm.
he said, "I'm not there, I'm here." And I saw him dancing and doing all kinds of stuff,
right.
And I thought, that's what people need to be experiencing
right.
and focusing on,
right.
because...
You know, and I have to say, my experiences are absolutely consistent with that, because many people who experience an induced after-death communication are no longer interested in visiting the grave.
Yes, exactly.
Because they say that's not where the person is.
Exactly.
That's just the body they left behind, that they're not there.
Right.
So, as a matter of fact, I told my family, listen, when I die, don't, you know, put me in a casket and have, you know, a bunch of holy rollers around and talking about how awful this is. And, you know, I want an NDE experiencer up there saying, what a lucky guy I am to be dead, and I must be having a good time right now.
You are so right, lad. In fact, my daughter's got a dear friend who, as we speak, is getting ready to transition, and I told her, well, admittedly, I envy him because he's getting ready to graduate, and I celebrate that for him. And, you know, when we can remind people that the body is just a garment. It's not us. It's not who we are.
Right.
It's just a garment that we discard when we no longer need it. It's an earth suit, you know, like cosmonauts, astronauts will wear spacesuits to accommodate the environment that they've got to sojourn through.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing here. We don a body while we're sojourning through this dense physical plane.
Right.
So, you know, this point that you and I are making are very important for people to realize we must not identify the person with the body. That's not the person. So this is really good. And also I tend to see people when they were kids or young or when they were in a very happy place in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Not how they looked when they were getting ready to transition or what
Well,
have you.
You know, it's so much fun to talk to people who come at this from a different point of view, like you. But what's great and gratifying about it is my experiences are almost identical to yours, but from a somewhat different perspective. In IADCs, the old, the sick, the wounded, the bleeding, and so on, they always in an IADC look young and healthy. They're not old and sick anymore. They don't have the disabilities that they had throughout life. You know, if there was a combat situation, they're no longer bloody. They're happy. They're smiling. Always younger.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so important for people to believe that, too, to trust that is real. And I'll give you another example with this man. He was, you know, a friend that I did music with in Nashville. And he had had a heart transplant. And typically heart transplants, you know, those people don't last usually more than 2 to 3 years.
Uh-huh.
So I only knew him in his deteriorated state. And unfortunately, he didn't look all that great, to be polite. And so when he crossed, and this was so interesting, this was the night before I went to the memorial, he kept coming to me through my dreams and even in the waking state, haunting me with a specific song called Dust My Broom. I was just having to remember. It's a blues song, and I'm not really a blues person.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were getting ready to do the memorial for him, I told our mutual friend, who's very close to me, who I also did music with, Roger kept talking about Dust My Broom, Dust My Broom. What is this all about? To sing Dust My Broom during the memorial. And Mike said, well, that was his signature song.
Uh-huh.
And he did it all the time. And then I was describing what Roger looked like, again, before I met him. And I even drew it, and he and his sister, I actually sang with with Roger's sister. And so Mike and Roger's sister, Terry Lynn, told me that's exactly what he looked like, that's exactly how he behaved.
Mm-hmm.
But I was seeing him when he was thriving, when he was healthy, when he was happy, when he was doing music, and quite a wild sort of fellow, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so these are very powerful affirmations, validations of what I had seen and experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm hoping that that's going to be a source of encouragement for, you know, our listeners and people as well, because, you know, I wouldn't have any way to make something like this up. I just share what I see. And
right.
Then they say, yes, well, that was exactly right.
Yeah.
So
probably one of the most interesting aspects of what I do, what I and my trained colleagues do now, is that there are have been numerous occasions in which two different people have the exact same ADC at the same time. In other words, one sort of eavesdrops in on the other's experiences and experiences all the details And of course, you have two people sitting there with their eyes closed after receiving this eye movement treatment, and they have the exact same experience. It's like they see the exact same thing.
Which I was going to ask you about that. That's really interesting. Now, do you have them both simultaneously engaged in the IADC with the rapid eye movement? How does that work?
Yes. Okay, there are actually two versions of this. The way we first stumbled into it is I had a colleague observing me induce one of my patients, and for some reason my colleague closed his eyes and gave himself eye movement, which just involved darting his eyes back and forth at a particular rhythm or a particular rate. And he didn't really expect anything to happen, but while I was performing the procedure on a patient, my colleague then experienced the same thing my patient did. So in that case, they were both receiving this bilateral stimulation, which allowed them to access the same material. I have trained some IADC therapists who seem to spontaneously connect with their patients' experiences without giving themselves any kind of eye movement or bilateral stimulation.
Well, that's interesting. Well, in a way, I'm not surprised.
They just seem to have a knack for it.
Yes, yes. Because I think, again, when people really start to understand what this is, it's so simple. And it will become very spontaneous and, you know, again, relaxing into it. In fact, back in Nashville, I was teaching a musician friend of mine about becoming a medium, how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting in my office, and it was kind of late, and he said, "Julia, I just saw something move over you." And I said, "Oh, wow." And I knew when he said that was an acquaintance who had just at that moment crossed over. It was 11 o'clock at night.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Wow, friend, good job." You know, he was already just really getting into it, and I was able to pick up on Earl, who had just transitioned. Sure enough, I got the call a little while later that Earl had indeed transitioned at the exact moment that my friend Daryl saw him.
And there's so many stories that I've read in books and so on, and many of my patients reported that they had like a healthy family member who suddenly died. And for example, they might be driving along the highway and feel a very powerful presence of that family member, and at the time not really understanding why they're feeling that strong presence and that strong feeling of love coming from that person. And then when they get home, you know, and listen to their voicemail, they find out that loved one had just passed. But, you know, those kind of experiences are very common.
Yes, indeed. And another aspect of that as well that I have shared with people is that one doesn't have to be on the other side in order to envelop you that way or to connect with you in that way. In fact, I was talking to a client of mine the other night who could feel the presence of someone very close to her who's out of town. He's still alive, but he was enveloping her, and I said, "That's a very powerful telepathic connection that you're making, and it's important that you trust that." So, again, I like to let people know that telepathy is the same whether somebody's on the other side or present on the physical plane. So that's, and there's another really good validation there.
I think ultimately, this is going to be explained by energy theory probably, and it's pretty clear that and biophysicists across the planet are reporting their research results, which indicate that all living things continually emit light. And that this light that we emit, which is not in the visible range, contains huge amounts of information about who we are and so on. And But anyway, I think ultimately NDEs and ADCs, I am hopeful that there will eventually be a science of this.
Boy, we're all working on that, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, I'd actually prefer to leave that to the researchers, but it's very interesting to speculate and think about. But you know, we're just getting started in this, is the way I see it, and hopefully, this mainstream science will at some point, come along and support what we're doing in some ways.
Well, I really feel like it's inevitable at this point because.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, every time I turn around now, I'm seeing something about NDEs, or just like somebody I just met yesterday started confiding and having had these experiences, and I said, wow, you're an NDE. Here's another one. And I think that there are a lot more of us than is currently even known, and it's just, it's become a household word that people are so familiar with. Near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, spiritually transformative experiences, light experiences, illumination experiences, whatever you want to call them, they're all connected and they're all valid. And I think they all really tap into the fact that we are, again, multi-sensory, multi-dimensional, and that the work that you are doing allows us to, I want to say, move at a higher vibrational frequency, and that we are able to pierce that veil and to connect again. It's something that is very, very normal and natural. I don't think there's anything woo-woo or weird or even supernatural about it.
Right. There's nothing scary or spooky about it.
Indeed.
A lot of people, say, well, isn't that spooky, or what about haunted houses, and what about, angry ghosts and all this kind of stuff? All of our thousands of experiences that I and my colleagues have induced, they're all positive, loving experiences. And when people have the experience, they just feel so natural and loving to them. There's nothing scary or spooky about it.
Yes. I always try to make that point as well, because having been on the other side a few times, it's luminous, it's beautiful, it's not dark and eerie. And,
right.
That's also made up, and it really frustrates me when that happens. Tell us what your website is, because we're getting down to the wire here. Tell us how people can contact you, how they can reach you, what your website is.
Okay. I can only train, I do train people in IADC, but for me to be able to train you in IADC, you already have to be level 1 EMDR trained. And to get level 1 EMDR training, you need to be recognized by your state as an independent provider of mental health services, which includes master's level nurse, psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, and certified professional counselors, and so on. I also have about 16 therapists I have trained listed on my website who are available to offer this therapy, and they are sort of scattered across the United States. There's even one in South America and Colombia. But if you are interested in getting this therapy, go to my website, which is induced-adc.com. I believe it also works without the hyphen. And you can go there. I have information on training, I have information on therapy, and so on. And also information on how to get my book, which explains the thing in some detail.
Yeah, and your book was put out by Hampton Roads.
Hampton Roads. Probably the easiest way to get my book is on Amazon, or to go to hrpub.com, and you can get it directly from the publisher. The name of it is Induced After Death Communication.
Okay. Yeah, this is really, really tremendous, and I'm very excited about it as well.
Well, thank you so much. I so much appreciate your support. My main goal is simply at this point to get this help to people who are suffering and who need it. And the more people I can train, the better I can do that.
I would tend to really share that with you. I'd love to see more people become practitioners. So again, I'm going to repeat your website, which is induced-ADC, which stands for afterdeathcommunication.com. And your book is on there, but also I'm going to put all of this information on my website, towardthelight.org. And if you go to the TTL radio guest page, you know, they'll be able to see a picture of you, which will take them to a page about you and your work, the hot link straight back to your website. So in case people forget or whatever, they can access you through my website, and I'll have your book on there as well. So this is tremendous. Do you have any special engagements, announcements, anything that you would like to share with our listeners before we sign off?
Well, I've got nothing coming up in the near future. I do have producers that, and we are working on getting a documentary film on IADC together. At this point, we've even done a 10-minute DVD promo, which turned out wonderful. And,
wonderful! Yes, indeed.
What we need now are investors, backers who would want to invest in our putting together a 90-minute film on this. But we're in the process of doing that, and hopefully that will work. Aside from that, that's about it. I have no other announcements at this point, I suppose.
Okay. What was it? Did you say it was a 10-minute DVD? Is that available? Is it for public view?
Well, at this point, my producers are asking that I not to send it out to people because I'm under a contractual kind of arrangement with them.
Yes.
And they certainly don't want anybody else to scoop them at this point with all the time, effort, and money they've already invested in it. So so it's not available to the public yet, but hopefully we'll have a full documentary that will be available for everybody sometime in the near future, if we can get the funding.
Well, I'm getting a really, really good feeling about that. I'm seeing it happening, and you can certainly count on me to be a supporter of this whole endeavor because it's very important that people do have this information, and it provides a profound feeling of hope, and indeed it does give results. And I was so fascinated, again, hearing you speak at the conference in Chicago. I just thought this was really, really tremendous, and I applaud you for this work that you're doing, and I'm so pleased that Spirit led you to this work where you are able to help people. And again, I want to let our audience know that you are inviting people to train through you, but you said that they've already got to be state certified before they can train for IADC.
Yeah.
So,
they need to be state certified and then get EMDR trained, and then I can train.
Okay.
And I don't mean to be elitist or exclusive. It's just that the procedure is fairly involved, and there is potential for harm if someone is not professionally trained and aware of some of the possible side effects and so on. It's actually a very safe procedure when it's in the hands of somebody who knows what he or she is doing.
Well, that's tremendous. Thank you so much, Dr. Allen. It's wonderful to have you again.
Well, thank you so much, Juliet. I very much appreciate you inviting me and supporting me.
Well, you are so welcome. We've been talking to Dr. Allen Botkin, who is a therapist who does induced after-death communications, and he's written a tremendous book that by the same name, Induced After-Death Communications, A New Therapy for Healing Grief and Trauma. You've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source, and I would like to remind you that it is only with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. We will speak to you next week. Blessings and light to all. Cheerio for now.